Welcome to Blazing Trails, a Salesforce podcast. I'm Sabrina Barakzai, social and content marketer for Salesforce Strategic Events. We are thrilled to bring you this podcast that gives you a snapshot of the trailblazing stories we experience and collect at our events around the world. Hear from inspirational speakers and conversations around game-changing innovations. You will learn how to blaze new trails, map your path to the future, and most importantly, be your best. In this episode, we're highlighting content from Dream Talks recorded at Dreamforce 2016 that discusses business and digital transformation. Dream Talks showcases thought leaders from across numerous industries and professions. Digital transformation is imperative for all businesses of all sizes. What is digital transformation? It is the profound changes necessary of business and organizational activities and processes to fully leverage the changes and advances of digital technology. But what does this mean in the age of the customer? Empowered customers are shaping business strategy. They expect both consistent and high-value experiences in person and digitally. Customers don't care if building these experiences are hard or require a complex, multifunction approach. They want immediate value and will go elsewhere if you can't provide it. We're in a once-in-a-lifetime marketplace shift, where every business needs to turn disruptions into opportunity or fall into the dreaded digital Darwinian chasm. George Colony is the founder, chairman, and CEO of Forrester Research and one of the most influential thought leaders in the world of business and technology. Colony joined us at Dreamforce 2016 to talk about how the customer isn't just king, the customer is everything. We are in the dawn of the customer age, the age where now isn't good enough. To be successful, you need to be ahead of the curve, which is to say, you need to be ahead of the customer and more, this happens at the individual level by listening to and then catering to customers' ever-changing wants, needs, and demands. Taking advantage of these customer-initiated moments not only results in greater customer satisfaction and retention, but serves as a competitive differentiator. Learn more in this Dream Talk from George Colony.
Great to see everybody. Great to be here at Dreamforce. This is a big, fantastic event. Great to be here. I've spoken the last 2 years. Thank you for all coming to see me for the next 25 minutes. I'm going to start out with a dramatic statement, but I think that it sums up the economic moment that we're in. My statement is that you are all going out of business. All the companies that you work with are going out of business slowly, but you don't know it as yet. Some of you may, but most of you don't even know that yet. There's a massive challenge which lays ahead, and I'm going to talk for a few minutes about that challenge, but I really want to talk about how you're going to confront that challenge, how you're going to meet that challenge over the next 2 to 3 years. In fact, how you're going to build what we call at Forrester a customer-obsessed operating model. But let's look at the challenge first. You may not know this about Forrester, but over the last 20 years, we've built a very big data business. We actually gather data on customers worldwide. And as we looked at our data over the last several years, we observed that power was shifting away from institutions like corporations or governments toward the customer. And that shift was being driven by technology primarily, the ability to price very precisely, the ability to gather information very precisely, the ability to buy anywhere. And so we believe that we are entering a period, a 20-year period, that follows the age of manufacturing, age of distribution, Tesco, Walmart, the age of information, and now we enter what Forrester and others call the age of the customer, a period where that power will continue to shift toward the customer over the next 20 years. Now, the customer is amazingly dynamic. For about every 2 years, Forrester, through our research, we take a snapshot of the customer and understand exactly how they're changing. So what I'm about to show you is new data we have on the customer, which has come out over the last, I think, 6 weeks, and it shows a picture of the customer which the customer having amazing velocity forward. The customer is, number one, willing to experiment. This is amazing. We're finding that there's a much faster uptake for new products from the customer than we saw even 2 to 3 years ago. We saw this with Amazon's Alexa, the willingness of the customer to move forward very fast, to adopt new technology very, very quickly. That has somewhat amazed us. Second, we all know this, device usage. This is the device where the customer is now focused. The web is a dying technology. We saw this with Google today with the talk about the Pixel phone, that Google has to be on this device to be relevant in the future. So the customer now very focused around the mobile device. An acceptance of this physical to digital integration. We saw this summer with Pokemon Go. I downloaded it to my phone, and there sitting on my desk was a Pokemon, which of course I captured, and I was off to the races. But this physical to digital now very accepted by the customer, very focused on information savvy, and then finally, it's all got to be about the customer. We call it self-efficacy, but essentially, what is it doing for me? How is it improving my life? Metrics, 3 points, you know, the old business school stupid quote is you can't manage what you don't measure. All of the customer-obsessed companies have very strong metrics around their customer experience and how they're performing, the value delivered to the customer. 3 points on metrics. Point one, what you're looking at here is the customer life cycle. The customer discovers you, explores you, buys from you, they use you, they ask you questions, and then they engage with you. First point of the metrics, your metric should be able to address all parts of the customer life cycle, the customer journey. That's one. Two, the metric should be able to give you prescription for what you have to change, where you're doing well, where you're doing badly, but more importantly, what you have to change. A metric like NPS it's good to know, but it doesn't give you prescription. So number two. And then number three, I have metrics on my slide, but I'm going to take that S out of the word. It's best if you can get to one metric. If your company can pray to one God, especially around all these aspects of the customer journey, you will be ahead. You'll have one language you can speak. You may be able to comp to that metric, but it can help you to a great extent if you can get to one metric. You don't want NPS over here and some Nielsen number over here and some customer sat over here. One would always be best. And we do observe that in the best performing companies. Process, obvious, right? That if you're customer obsessed, if you have great customer experience, you're always working on process. Here's a personal story I have about process, which I love to tell, because it hits this point so well. I was at LaGuardia Airport in New York trying to get to Boston. This is like 3 months ago, and I was flying on Delta. And if you know Delta, Delta has spent a five-year voyage trying to improve their customer experience. And I went to my gate, the flight canceled, I got really pissed off. I said, okay, so I went to a restaurant, sat down, had a bunch of nice restaurants here in LaGuardia with the Delta gates. I had dinner, and then they called my flight. I was on another flight, got all my stuff, got on the flight. I'm sitting down on the plane, and just as I sit down, I say, oh, I can't believe it. I forgot my iPad. I got up. I was going to run off the plane and grab it. I stood up, and coming right at me down the aisle was a flight attendant with my iPad. She said, Mr. Colony, here's your iPad. I actually researched that afterwards. That was not a heroic event for Delta. They actually built a process called when our customers leave stuff in the restaurant. That's true. They built that process. They connected the credit card system to the flight system, to the seat designation, and they were able then to deliver that iPad directly to me. So that was not by mistake. That actually happened on purpose. And the last area that the great customer-obsessed companies work on is technology. I'm going to address that in more detail. So to describe the DNA of the customer-obsessed companies, I described the six areas that they work on. Let's go deeply into two of those areas where they work. One is culture. I've defined it for you. I'm just going to tell you, I spent all my life with these companies. And you can smell it. You can touch it. It's different. It is palpable. It's measurable. But it is there in those companies. They're thinking in different ways. They're breathing different air. They're breathing a different gas of some sort. It is just very, very different. And by the way, I never thought when I launched Forrester, you know, Forrester's always been about technology, that we would be out there helping companies with culture. But as it turns out, if you want to be customer obsessed, you've got to work this one. This is mutable. You've got to work this one. And I could give a two-hour speech on this, but I'm going to do this in 30 seconds. Three big points on culture. One, got to be your first stop. I kind of think I've already got this point across to you. You will not be able to survive the age of the customer. You will not be able to drive your revenue as this intensifies if you don't change the culture. The other six that they work on, you can kind of fudge some of those, but this one's unfudgeable. You cannot fudge this guy. Number two, you can't do it from the middle, and you can't do it from the bottom. Either your CEO is in or it's not going to get done. You cannot go to the CEO with a good idea and say, hey, we need a better culture. Never going to happen. It must be CEO-led. And by the way, in all the companies that Forrester looks at or who score highly in the Customer Experience Index, we watch those CEOs really closely. We read their letters. We watch their speeches. We know them. And they have this. They drive this. They have it. It's in them. And the last one, this is kind of interesting. You probably could intuit this one. But good employee culture, as we found, equals good customer culture. You know, an airline, you know, American Airlines can have really nice planes and can have a really good system, a reservation system, but if you get on the plane and the flight attendant is rude to you because they have a bad union contract of some sort, the employee experience is going to be diminished or destroyed. So good employee culture, we found, equals good customer culture. And we correlated high-scoring CXI companies with Glassdoor scores. If you don't know who Glassdoor is, that's where employees grade their companies. And very interesting, we saw overall rating a difference, culture and values, willingness to recommend, CEO approval. And if you know anything about Glassdoor, those are actually very large deltas that I'm showing you. So companies who have great internal cultures, great employee cultures, will in fact imbue a great customer culture. A lot of examples here. Here's one of our favorites, TXU Energy. This was a formerly regulated energy company. I think they're in Texas. But the X factor is experience. The center of our brand represents our commitment to every customer experience. I mean, they are just swimming in this. The CEO, he has an award every quarter for employees who, and by the way, this could be their CFO or accountants even in the company, but somehow, some way, what they did in that quarter affected or improved the experience of the customer. So I don't have enough time to talk about it, but it's a very cool case study to look at. If you want to see a company which has gone from very regulated to now being very focused on the customer, some of the signage you see there. Okay, last thing I'm going to talk about, because I'm running out of time here, is technology. A lot of us are technologists in this room. I'm going to give you a little test, which, by the way, I'll give you the test, but I'm going to answer the test myself. So I bought a new car in May. You know I love cars if you ever read my blog. My Tesla S on the left and my Audi A8, which that's my fourth Audi A8. It's about 3 years old. And so the question for all of you is, why is the Tesla better than the A8? Okay, is it this? One of my sons. It's very quiet. Is it this? If you ever wonder how a Tesla plugged in, here's how it plugs in. So is it self-driving? It's kind of cool. It's pretty neat. Is it the fact that the car runs on electrons, electric motor propulsion? I would argue that the real difference between my Tesla S and my Audi is not those two, but it's this one. So what you're looking at here is a notice I got in my car on Wednesday night of last week. And what it's saying is that at 1 a.m., I guess that would be Thursday morning, you're going to get a download, which is going to take an hour and 40 minutes, and we're going to download Tesla S. It's called Tesla S, which is the new upload or the new refresh for the software of the car. It's the biggest refresh ever in the history of the Tesla S. When I got into that car Thursday morning to drive to work, totally changed. The autopilot was totally different. The screen was totally different. The interface to music was way improved. Many parts of the car had changed, even the way the car drove. So I would argue the difference between the Audi and Tesla is that Tesla is sending me what we call at Forrester business technology. The technology for me, the customer, is far better in the Tesla than it is in the Audi. The Audi never changed. I bought it 3 years ago, it never changed. The Tesla is always improving. So a major factor we see in customer-obsessed companies is that they think about the technology of their company in two segments. They think of business technology, and business technology is very simply defined as the systems, processes, and technologies to win, serve, and retain customers, versus IT. IT is the technology which runs the internals of their companies. By the way, IT has to be brilliant. Companies would go out of business in seconds if IT wasn't fantastic. But the great companies think about business technology and IT. And a couple of points here, another topic I could spend a lot of time on, but a couple of points on BT versus IT. This is somewhat of an artificial, overly dramatic way to approach this. But we believe that you should budget BT separately from IT. Now, the reason I say it's overly dramatic is that, in fact, IT and BT are hard to rip apart. Because in all of our companies, there's lots of connection here. But if you budget BT and IT separately, you're going to make sure that you're funneling money to the BT side of your business, which is where you're going to win customers. I'm going to give you a number here, but according to Forrester's research, in 2016 in the U.S., U.S. only, we're going to spend $1.544 trillion on technology. Of that number, 68% will be IT and 32% will be BT. So it's about one-third, two-thirds. But here's the punchline. BT is growing at twice the rate of IT. So when you budget, you should be roughly about one-third, two-thirds, with the proviso, with the thinking, that within 2 to 3 years, these budgets will be about 50-50. But it's important to budget separately, because if you don't do this, IT is going to run over BT every time. It's what I call IT gravity. when you're doing the budgeting, you have to rationalize IT to fund BT. You know, what is cloud all about? What is virtualization all about? What is outsourcing all about in IT? It is, we're pursuing all those activities so we can drop the cost in IT to funnel that money up into the BT world. And by the way, if you're wondering, we're all Salesforce connected here. If you're wondering where Salesforce.com comes in, Salesforce.com is one of the most important business technologies in the world today, CRM and other parts of it. And then finally, build BT in collaboration with the CMO. So this is a very important point. BT is not simply the province of the CIO. BT successfully is built in those companies we talked about as a partnership between the CIO, the CMO, and the business head. It's what I call the holy trinity of business technology, that those three executives in a very densely collaborative space are the ones who are building BT. This is not simply the CIO, not simply the CMO, but in the most successful companies, they are heavily cooperative around BT. Okay, my slide said before, the age of the customer is arriving, but it has arrived. It is here. Walmart is losing market share because another company is more competitive with the customer than they are. To use a baseball term, sorry about this, but we're about probably the top of the second inning. So we're at the beginning of this voyage. But this is, as I showed you, when we looked at the customer, it's only going to intensify. The only way forward for you is you're going to have to master the customer-obsessed operating model to survive. I'm not saying do all, what I had a list of four DNAs and six things to work on. I'm not saying you've got to do all 10 of those, but you've got to begin your path down that voyage to be, in fact, customer-obsessed. Anyway, hope this helped very much. Have a great Dreamforce. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Tom Davenport is one of the world's top 25 consultants and the president's distinguished professor in management and IT at Babson College. Davenport has taught at Harvard Business School and Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business and directed research centers at Accenture and McKinsey. An author or co-author of 15 books and more than 100 articles, simply put, he helps organizations revitalize their management practices. In this Dream Talk, Davenport discusses how the age of the customer has transformed customer expectations and how to make customer-facing processes more intelligent. Customer-facing processes like sales, marketing, and service have been the focus of increasing amounts of technology, but they need to become substantially more intelligent. Listen in.
What we're going to do with all the data that we get from our customer-facing processes. And I'm going to argue that we've gotten ourselves in a little bit of a pickle, and there's really only one way out of it. The pickle is that we've got too much or too many of almost everything these days. We've got too many channels that we have to coordinate to the customer. We've got too much data that we have to analyze. Much of the data is problematic in some way or the other. And you know, I worked in analytics and big data over the last 15 or 20 years. The dirty little secret of analytics and big data is that most of the time we spend on analytics and big data is on cleaning up our data. And we really need to address that issue, as I'm sure many of you deal with day to day. We have too many customers wanting a personalized approach to the business that we do with them. And we've been trying segmentation for ages. I think now the expectation among customers is a segment of one, but most of us wrestle with segments of 10 million or 20 million. So that's a challenge. Too much expertise required to do all of this data and analytics-oriented work. I mean, we would almost need as many data scientists as we have people in San Francisco. I know we're approaching that, but we're not quite there yet, if we were going to pull this off. And there just aren't that many people with the right kind of training and expertise to make all of this happen. There are too many tasks to be done in terms of serving customers and making them happy. And you know, George talked about culture. I certainly believe in culture, but the particular brand of culture that people often espouse to me is necessary is a culture driven by data and analytics as opposed to intuition and experience. And, you know, we're going to shoot the hippo, the highest paid person's opinion, as far as being the arbiter of what happens in our organization. It ain't happening, at least not fast enough. Culture change takes a long time. We still have a vast number of executives who are not trained in data and analytics-based decision-making, who are more than happy to continue with the highest paid person's opinion because they are the highest paid person and they like some of the perquisites of that particular office. So my sense is we're not going to get that cultural change by the natural mechanisms of cultural change. We're going to have to do it another way. And I think in many cases, technology is the answer. I was at another gathering of chief data and analytics officers, and I was talking to, I won't mention his name, but a senior executive at Wells Fargo. Boo, Wells Fargo. And I was saying, well, what's it like to work there now? And he said, it's a fantastic situation for us because it's finally going to make people in the bank see that technology can solve some of these problems. It would have been relatively easy to check on whether Wells Fargo people were opening millions and millions of accounts that customers didn't want. But the feeling was, no, we don't need that. So in many cases, I think we can start to make some cultural changes through the use of technology, and I think that has to be done here. So what's going to happen? What's already happening? I woke up this morning and I read that Salesforce had acquired yet another AI company, YAAIC, a veritable shopping spree of AI. And it's because in customer-facing processes, we can't solve all of those problems with traditional technology and certainly not with cultural and behavioral and process change alone. So Salesforce and others started with transactional CRM capabilities. Make sure that your call report is in and your trouble tickets and service and so on. And then a few years ago, Salesforce said, well, it'd be pretty useful if we kind of baked some descriptive analytics into this transactional capability so we can know what are our sales and service and marketing people really doing with their time and how's it all working. And then they said, well, we can get a little bit more sophisticated and start to predict what might be happening, predict a customer that might be about to attrit from us, for example. And then why not just push it out to the front lines with prescriptive analytics where we say, excuse me, but this customer has not been responded to in a couple of weeks. Sales IQ reads it and says, you got to do something. Would you like me to send an email? Because you don't seem to be capable of it. So starting to kind of take over some tasks and at least make strong suggestions about how the work should be done. And increasingly, I think we're getting to the point where we can no longer rely on the humans to do this. We're unreliable. We go on vacations. We get sick, etc. So more and more is happening in terms of autonomous analytics, where instead of us doing the analysis at Salesforce now, as of a month ago or so, BeyondCore will tell us, look, here's a really important pattern in the data that you missed. It's not hypothesis-driven anymore. It's not artisanal analytics, the kind they have in Portland, Oregon. It's starting to get autonomous. And then finally, it's not just the analytics that get made autonomous or automated. It's the sales or service or marketing tasks themselves. And this is not the future, folks. This is the present and in some cases already the past. So we're moving toward a more automated future, but there's a problem with that plan because most of us don't really like automation all that much. I mean, first of all, it has this nasty side effect of putting some of us out of work. I'll say more about that later, but that's not so much fun. How many of you, when you're faced with an IVR system, in a company, you say, agent, representative, please, a human, anybody? you press every number on the keypad to see what might get you to a human. I mean, if automation is so great, why do we do that? Interaction with so-called smart machines is often awkward. I mean, I just got my new Series 2 Apple Watch, and it's kind of beeping and buzzing at all sorts of inconvenient times, usually when there are other people around. Why is your watch yelling at you? Siri, you know, you have to say things over again. It's getting better. It's always getting better, this automation, but it's always still problematic somehow. You also, if you think about it, automation is kind of a race to the bottom. If everybody in your industry automates, then the costs get cut out, but the margins get cut out, and it becomes more difficult to be innovative because everybody's kind of programmed in a certain process that is now much harder to change. So I think pure automation leaves something to be desired, but clearly we are facing more of it. And so the question is this historical pattern that we've been seeing over the last few centuries, is it going to continue into customer-facing knowledge workers? Some of you probably fall into this category yourselves. So we saw industrial workers, manual workers, dislocated, as the economists call it, in the 18th and 19th centuries in farms and factories and so on. And then it's been service workers in the 20th century, the bank tellers and the airline reservations clerks and so on, who were no longer needed. And now it's the knowledge workers, the people who do the heavy lifting of the knowledge economy. And the scary thing is, this was the higher ground to which we were all supposed to repair when the lower level jobs were eliminated. So to this pressing question, are customer facing jobs next to go? I have a very clear and unambiguous answer. Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that lots of customer-facing tasks are automatable and, as I will show, already automated in many cases. But note the word tasks, not entire jobs. You know, we do a lot of tasks in our jobs, and some of them are automatable and some of them are not. And so what that, I think, really means is that we won't need quite as many people performing these things as we did in the past, but they won't all go away. So maybe 8 call center reps instead of 10, because the more routine tasks have been automated by some sort of AI system to answer customer questions. The other thing to remember is that job elimination is a pretty slow process. Good news for all of us, maybe not as good news for our children and our grandchildren. In 1980, in the United States, I mentioned bank tellers before, 1980, we had 500,000 bank tellers in the U.S. So along came ATMs to dispense cash anytime, and online banking to do basically anything that you would possibly need to do with a bank online. How many bank tellers do you think we have in 2016? 500,000, strangely enough. So people find other jobs, and the banks were opening more branches during this period. So it's a slow process, but I don't think any of you are probably recommending to your friends and relatives, join the fast-growing field of bank telling, if that's what it's called. It's in a slow decline, and that's what happens with these kinds of jobs. The good news is that there will be new jobs. Christine Lagarde, the head of the IMF, said it just yesterday. Technology will create new jobs. The bad news is that we don't know how many, and chances are pretty good there won't be quite as many of them around as there are today. And of course, if this works, we'll have productivity gains, and we could use those gains to retrain people or even give them minimum basic incomes, all that sort of thing. But I don't know. I suppose it depends partially on who's going to get elected. But this country doesn't feel right now that we're into the idea of guaranteed basic incomes. And most other countries, there are some in Europe that are playing with it, but Switzerland voted it down. And so it kind of goes against the current grain. In general, I think there is no room for complacency here. There probably are going to be fewer jobs. I don't know if you can see this little bear over here, but I'm reminded of that old joke about the campers out in the woods and a bear comes upon them, probably a little bigger than this one over here. And one of the campers starts to take off and the other one is putting on running shoes. And the first one says, well, what are you doing? What are you wasting time for? And he said, no, I want to be a really fast runner. Well, you know, the bear's coming. I said, I don't have to outrun the bear. I just have to outrun you. So, and I think that will be to some degree the case. We have to make ourselves more valuable than other people who are not willing to work with smart machines as effectively as we are. So, lest you doubt that there's any concern, here are 10 jobs, knowledge work jobs, for which a big chunk of the work is already automated. I'll only focus in this presentation on the customer-facing ones because that's presumably your focus being here at Dreamforce, but sales, of course, a lot of aspects of that, automated call center reps, marketers. I probably should, had I known what was going to be in the paper this morning, I probably should have put Crux in that example of AI for marketing, since that's the company that Salesforce just announced they bought. And if you think, well, I'm an analyst, I'm a quantitative analyst, no fear, plenty of jobs for me. Well, even that, much of that work is being automated through machine learning. And there are also, you know, doctors, lawyers, reporters, etc., whose jobs are being placed at risk by this technology. So let's get into a little bit of detail. How about sales? Lots and lots of sales tasks already automated, from outbound content marketing. I don't know if this is a surprise to you, but those personalized emails, I should say personalized emails that you get in your mailbox, no human actually saw those. I'm sure we all realize now that some program said this is what you wanted to receive in your inbox. The fact that you didn't really want to receive that in your inbox also tells us something about the personalization process. Prospecting, lead scoring, if even if you have been to the Einstein section of Dreamforce, you see a lot of these functions are getting built into Salesforce now, which I think makes a lot of sense, all the way through to customer attrition modeling, pricing. We have these robotic process automation tools that can do a lot of back office work. And you say, well, is this true of all salespeople? No, it's not. We don't know exactly, but McKinsey did an analysis to say which sales jobs are the most likely to be automated. Now, how many parts salespeople do we have here today? Part salespeople, I guess the idea is humans don't add a lot of value to that process because 85% of their tasks are deemed automatable by McKinsey. But then you get down to the bottom where product demos and so on, I guess it's good news for a lot of people here at Dreamforce because if you're a product demonstrator, only 17% of your tasks are likely to be automated, and other kind of sales-oriented tasks in the middle. I think in some ways this is the fallacy of precision, but it does suggest, I think quite rightly, that some jobs will be more automated than others in the sales domain. In terms of marketing, marketing always had this kind of fun flavor. You probably remember that old Dilbert cartoon where Dilbert's looking at another part of the office and there's a big banner and a party going in. It says, welcome to marketing, 2-drink minimum. A fun place to be for people, but now not so much because there aren't nearly as many people as there used to be. And a lot of the creativity has been taken over by various automated tools, from digital ad buying, so-called programmatic buying, all the way down to next best offers, social media, A/B testing. Most of that stuff is automated. There's still some creative work, sure. There's still some marketing strategy work. If you're buying a commercial for the Super Bowl, you still probably want to have a human make the decision. But if it's a relatively small decision to be made, there are just too many to leave it to the humans. And in services, we see it too. You hear a lot now about predictive maintenance, telling you that that jet engine needs to be serviced now and not at a certain interval, and supplying answers to what the problem is. More and more organizations are trying to do that. So in all of these customer-facing functions, we're seeing pretty dramatic inroads by AI-based technologies. And so the question becomes, what does that I mean, how many humans do we have in the crowd today? So hard to tell these days. But the question becomes, for us humans, what's the impact? What does it mean? And so I'm a very strong advocate of this idea of augmentation. I just wrote a book called Only Humans Need Apply, Winners and Losers in the Age of Smart Machines. And what augmentation means is that smart humans are going to be working alongside smart machines in a lot of different ways. If you're not a smart human, maybe cause for some alarm, but if you have the ability to learn new skills and learn how these machines work, you're probably going to be okay. Just as, you know, even though chess playing computers are now better officially than humans at playing chess, the best chess in the world is played by freestyle chess, a human with a lot of different computers in front of them saying, should I do this move or that move or that move? And the human makes the final call. So in a way, we want the work equivalent of freestyle chess. So my co-author and I developed 5 approaches to keeping your job. You know, if you feel like you need to leave now, that's fine. I understand there's a lot going on. But if you'd like to keep your job, pay attention to these 5. There's stepping in, we call it. This is kind of the belly of the augmentation beast, doing work alongside the machine day to day, monitoring its performance, handling exceptions, fixing it when it goes down, maybe even improving it a little bit if you have enough understanding of how the thing works. I'll illustrate this in a second with sales-oriented jobs. Stepping up is kind of a managerial role. I always think of the prototypical hedge fund manager as a step-up role where all the stocks and bond trading and hedge funds is done by machine, but somebody looks at the entire portfolio and says, how's it going? You know, do we need more automation, less automation, different automation, and so on. So it's kind of a manager of automation in a sense. Stepping aside is saying, I'm not going to compete with these really smart machines. I'm going to do something that they can't really do. There is maybe a highly creative job, empathetic job. I don't have to look very far for this, an example of this, because my son is a TV comedy writer. Now, humans are not that great at TV comedy writing. My son is good, of course, but all the other ones are not that great. But computers are even worse, a lot worse. There have been a few attempts, and they're really, really lousy. So I think my son is going to be off my payroll for a while longer. So think about a job that you're not competing with these machines that can do structured and mathematical tasks so much better than we can. There's also stepping narrowly, where you do something so in such a niche that nobody would be motivated to automate it. I initially thought of this. I was reading about a guy in Boston who, what he does for his job apparently pays really well. He drives a Rolls Royce around the streets of Boston. He connects buyers and sellers of Dunkin' Donuts franchises. That's it. And you think, well, computers are really good at connecting buyers and sellers of things. Why hasn't that been automated? It's just too narrow. Nobody would ever think of, you know, sitting down and writing a program that would do just that thing. So focus very narrowly in if you want to be in this category. And then finally, there are going to be a lot of people building these machines. I mean, I think Salesforce has probably hired thousands of them in the last few months with its acquisition. So 5 different alternatives here for playing a role alongside these smart machines and still having something good to do. So if you think about it in terms of sales, step in could be you're very aware of how sales automation and purchasing systems work. I think you'll always have a job if you can help to improve those. Stepping up is where sales managers kind of monitor the outcomes of the entire process. Stepping aside is you focus on things that, again, machines aren't very good at. Consultative sales. You know, the McKinsey study said real estate sales, pretty safe because, you know, you got to show somebody a house. You got to make sure they don't steal the owner's stuff. Computers aren't as good at that as humans are. Stepping narrowly, you know, that one's a little harder, but you think, well, I don't know, maybe flea market sales. Or I actually found somebody who was advertising for cicada removal. And this is a tough job because it's really only valuable every 17 years. But the good news is that nobody's going to automate it. And then finally, stepping forward, you help companies like Salesforce build these new systems. with your expertise in sales. So what does all this mean for sales organizations? I think you want to have people working with you, not against you, on all of these changes. So why not say from the beginning, I think the boldest companies are saying, we're not going to lay anybody off just because of this technology. We might still fire you if you're unproductive or you do something really stupid or whatever, but not because of this technology are we going to get rid of people, which inspires creativity in thinking about how we use this stuff. And maybe you get your productivity gains through attrition or something like that. Identify the areas where you think tasks can be automated, you know, maybe sales execution oriented tasks as opposed to sales management oriented tasks. Pick the right cognitive technology for your problem. There are a bunch of them out there, from natural language processing to machine learning to deep learning to rules and so on. Not all of them are well suited to every purpose. So if you're going to at least develop this yourselves, make sure you're picking the right one. Do some detailed work design. Think about what are the humans going to do, what are the machines going to do, and how are they going to collaborate with each other. Give people some time to make this transition and to choose among the five steps and tell them what it means. You may want to put somebody in charge of this. I mean, there is going to be so much stuff coming out of Salesforce alone that you almost need a kind of a sales automation manager or marketing automation manager. In fact, these roles are starting to appear. And finally, I would say it's time to get moving on this stuff. This is not the future. This is the present. Start thinking yourself.
Next time on Blazing Trails, we'll take you into the national park we call Trailhead DX. Trailhead DX is Salesforce's must-attend developer conference, where engineers, scientists, and product leaders guide attendees on a path of discovery and adventure. Trailhead DX also has fireside chats and panels discussing how technology has the potential to influence and change the world for the better. Join us next week to learn more. Thank you again for joining us on Blazing Trails. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts to keep up with exclusive content from amazing trailblazers. Rate and review us on iTunes to help us spread the word.